Recordings have begun.
Thank you so much, Aisha. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, everybody, and welcome to the IGO/NGO Curative Rights Protection PDP Working Group call on the 12th of November 2014. On the call today, we have Jay Chapman, Gary Campbell, Peter Reinforth, Alexander Lehmann, Osvaldo Navoa, David Heasley, Val Sherman, George Kirikas, Mason Cole, and Phil Corwin. We have received apologies from David Maher and Christine Durain. From staff, we have Mary Wong, Barry Cobb, Steve Chan, and myself, Marco Kerrigan. I'd like to remind you all to please state your names before speaking for transcription purposes. Thank you ever so much, and over to you, Phil.
Okay. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, whatever it may be, where you are. This is the call for the IGO/INGO Curative Rights Process Working Group. And any changes in statements of interest since our last call? I hear none. Mary, I'm in a situation, my laptop has acted up where I am, and I'm just in the process of rebooting it, so I can't look at the agenda. So can you tell me the next agenda item, please?
Sure. We had as the next agenda item to continue the deliberations that have already been started and that have been quite active on the list on the potential differences between IGOs and INGOs for purposes of our PDP, and further to that, potentially differentiating between the Red Cross and the IOC, who are the two INGOs that the GAC has said have special protections versus the other INGOs. I do note, however, that Paul Keating is not on the call, so that may be something to consider bringing back to the list to the extent there's any additional talking points, since Paul was quite active in earlier discussions. So that is the next agenda item, Phil, and the one following that would be qualifying requirements and so forth.
Right, and sorry, I missed who was on the call. Do other members want to speak to that? We can revisit it when Paul is next on it, and he's been prolific in sharing his views with us.
Phil, if I may,
yes.
This is Mary again. Just for working group members who may not have participated in recent or many GNSO working groups, I think one of the issues that Paul may have raised, not the substantive ones, but in terms of process, is whether there are others who feel the same as he does in terms of there being or there not being, you know, sufficient reasons and grounds for the proposed differentiation. Obviously, there is a difference between consensus and full consensus in the GNSO. Equally, obviously, as many veterans will know, this is not something that is being subject to a formal consensus call at the moment, but it will be very helpful for documentation purposes as well as for other reasons to get a sense of the working group members as to whether many or most folks feel that there is or there is not a reason or reasons to differentiate. And we can, of course, record that there was or there was not. And so I just wanted to highlight that, Phil, as we go into the discussions, because on the list there were several working group members that expressed support. Paul has argued against it, and so I think the question now is next steps on that before we document the decision and move on to the next question.
Okay, well, that's do others on the call want to speak to that?
George has raised his hand, Phil.
Okay, and again, I apologize, I'm not in the chat room. I'm still rebooting my laptop. Unfortunate technical difficulties. Yeah, go ahead, George.
George Grigo speaking. I think the point that Paul Keating was trying to make was that there's a bigger picture, i.e. whether IGOs and INGOs would be treated differently than anybody else. And there were, I guess, the three main prongs, which were, you know, do they have trademark rights at all? And we've kind of talked about this on the mailing list, but they could probably meet the standard of having common law trademarks in many cases, whether or not they're listed on the Article 6 TER database or not. Basically, the common law trademarks provides a lower threshold than having any registered rights, per se. The second issue was the costs, whether costs are, you know, certainly different for them versus anybody else, which is, you know, a big point. And the third issue was the mutual jurisdiction slash immunity issue. And I sent an email to the list last week about the U.S. State Department's position on that, where IGOs wanted the U.S. government to intervene regarding, I guess, the unifem.com domain name. Because they own
Unifem. George, on that one, can we defer that till later in this call? Because I want to speak to that. I think that was very important, but I think it's separate from the issue. Let me say at this point, it was my impression on the last call that there was pretty widespread consensus that there was no need to do for other than perhaps the IOC and Red Cross because of their specific identification by the DAC, that there was no need to look at INGOs separately because they were simply private sector, nonprofit organizations with no bars to registering trademarks and no sovereign immunity issue in any way. Does anyone disagree? I think that, you know, we've been moving toward the position that we're not going to discuss INGOs other than perhaps Red Cross and the Olympic Committee and just deal with the IGOs. Am I correct in that? Anyone have a different view on that?
Phil, Jim Bykoff.
Yeah.
No, I think you have the right view. Also, I just want to say that on behalf of the IOC, we have no problem using the curative remedies, and we're not seeking any assistance on that score.
Right. Okay, so that leaves us with the IGOs, and I think Paul's position was, there's no need to differentiate for them either, but my personal view is that we're not at that point yet, and that even if we decide that they can utilize some version of the existing processes of UDRP and URS, that we may need some minor adjustments in terms of standing and perhaps other issues for them to use that. I'm not arguing at this point that we need to create an entirely new curative rights process for them, which would be an entirely different thing. Does anyone, what are the views on that? I think we still need to investigate IGOs quite a bit longer. And in that regard, I think the information George shared last week was quite useful.
Phil, Mary, again, can I be in the queue?
Sure.
And seeing no other hands, I'll just plunge ahead. So a couple of points before we get to your last question. One is that what staff will do then is write up a summary of the discussions to date as best we can about this specific question of IGOs versus INGOs for purposes of moving forward. One question that I did have for Jim especially, but also for everyone else, is with respect to the second specific sub-question, which is distinguishing the Red Cross and the IOC from the other INGOs, I understand that the IOC is not seeking anything particular from this PDP. We don't have representatives of the Red Cross on this working group, and that may be a matter for further discussion at some point with the GAC, for example. However, my question for now is, since the Red Cross and the IOC were specifically noted by the GAC in various pieces of their advice as being non-governmental organizations that have a special status, if I can use the term, based on international legal protection and protection in multiple national jurisdictions. I just wanted to ask, like I said, Jim and the working group to if we can spell out the rationale perhaps for not making an exception for the RC and the IOC in this case. In other words, when we say differentiate between IGOs and INGOs, we mean also that the Red Cross and the IOC are in the INGO camp and not further distinguished. I think that would be very helpful for record purposes as well as for potential questions that our working group may be asked by the GAC and by others in the future.
Well, if I can answer, Mary, it's Jim Bykoff. I think that while the Red Cross and the IOC are INGOs, there's no question about that, they do have a special status that's been recognized through their protection under international treaties and national legislation. Specific statutes in many countries protect their names and marks. So I think that they are somewhat special in the sense that they have this special protection that's been granted for many, many years for their names and logos. So I think that sets them a little bit apart from the normal INGOs, but they do fall in the INGO category without question. I hope that helps.
Yes, thank you, Jim.
So, Jim, on the issue of dropping them, are you suggesting that we should defer on that for now because they do have some special international recognition and protections that most INGOs don't have, or are you agreeing to drop them?
I'm agreeing to drop them because I don't think either one is seeking any special any special means to access curative remedies. Both of them, I think both of them have registered trademarks. Both of them have used the UDRP many, many times without any hindrance because of their status. So I think that they fall in the categories that we've been discussing. They have trademarks. They've used the UDRP. They're not asking for any special treatment or any different access methods to get into those remedies. So I think they should be dropped also.
Phil, Petter, and then George have their hands up.
Yeah, thank you for handling that. I apologize, but I'm having intense laptop difficulties. And
no problem. Petter input here. I think it's good, even if we don't have direct representatives from the ISOs and Red Cross in the group. We have attorneys and people that have actually been dealing a lot with these disputes for them, and that you also agree that they should not be counted into the same group as the IGOs. Then I had more a formal question that maybe Mary can reply to. Before we proceed to concentrate our work to IGOs, are there any specific formalities to set down that decision? Do we need to write something in a specific format just to note that we'll go further with that? And also, do we need to connect with the council to confirm that, or can we just move on as we are? Thanks.
So, Phil, I'm going to jump in here ahead of George and respond specifically
sure.
to Petter's questions. So, Petter, on your question about how we proceed, this is really looking ahead to the initial report that, as you know, when we come up with it, will have to be published for public comment. And so the decisions and the rationales will have to be recorded. There is no formal actual requirement as to, you know, how we do that. It's simply record-keeping at this point. The formal consensus call of the working group will come at the end when we actually have specific policy recommendations. That said, and on your second question, on the staff side, we would recommend that some sort of preliminary report, well, an oral report, an update, if you like, a five-minute update, be given to the GNSO Council maybe at its next meeting in December, presumably alerting them, as well as through them their constituencies and groups, that here's what we've done so far and here's how we propose to proceed. On that point, at the council meeting tomorrow, the point that there is no current liaison to the group from the council will be noted and brought up. In the absence of such a liaison, as staff, we have been serving the information function and obviously would be happy to continue to do that if the working group were to agree that a status report, at least orally, to the council at the next meeting would be useful.
Okay, and in terms of liaison, you know, is Mason on the call today? I can't see the attendee list.
Yeah, I'm here, Phil.
Yeah, you know, you can say no, Mason. I'm thinking, you know, if we need a GNSO liaison to this group, already on the group, and you know, the key liaison to the GAC, and this group exists because of a GAC request, so you may be the most logical person. I don't think it would add any burdens to you. You're already involved with the group, so it's not like we have to bring you up to speed on what our discussions are or what our thinking is.
That's probably doable.
Okay. Okay. Well, that would be good.
So, Phil, the next person in the queue is George.
George.
Go ahead, George.
Yeah, George Kirkus speaking. I want to follow up two things. First, I want to follow up on Jim Spycock's earlier points. I just wanted to know whether he could clarify whether the costs issue was a big concern for the Red Cross or the IOC, his clients. Also, whether the mutual jurisdiction issue has been much of a hurdle. Like, he has brought the EDRP before. I just want to get his direct input on those because he mostly focused on whether they had the trademarks registered. Second point was that we do have Gary Campbell on the call today, who is from the GAC, and we might benefit from having him speak a little bit because we spoke a lot about the GAC the last couple of phone calls, to having an actual GAC member present.
Sure.
It's a unique opportunity to hear from him.
Well, I think we welcome his input at any time. I don't know if he has anything he wants to say at the moment.
Phil, I'm not seeing any hands up, but I guess, George, your question was directed first to Jim and then secondly to Gary, so I don't know if Jim or Gary, either of you, would like to respond.
Okay, it's Jim. I can respond. I can respond on behalf of the IOC. There is no cost concern. These are nominal fees and certainly much less than litigation in courts would entail. Secondly, there's no jurisdiction issue.
Right,
does
right.
Does that answer your question, George?
I guess George speaking. Thanks, Jim.
Okay.
Yeah, I would just observe, of course, the Olympic Committee is not a typical INGO, you know, I'm not arguing to continue. I just want to note for the record that it's a fairly well-off organization. And my understanding in terms of the Red Cross that the problem was not with the big, with the International Red Cross organization, but with some of the local country Red Crosses had cost concerns. But I don't think they have other concerns in that regard.
Well, Phil, Jim Bykoff again, for the record, I had represented the Red Cross previously, and filing somewhere is around 10 or 12 UDR fees, and cost was never a concern at that time. Now, that was the U.S. Red Cross. I don't know if other local committees have had what they've done. I'm not really privy to that, but costs were not an issue on the ones that were filed on behalf of the American Red Cross.
Okay. All right. Well, I think regardless of the details, I think the consensus of the group seems to be that our further work will we've already agreed we were not going to look at IN, that there was no good reason to look further at INGOs except perhaps the Red Cross and the IOC, and we seem to be reaching the point where Jim, who represents the IOC and has represented the Red Cross, has agreed that there's no need to even do further work on those groups, which would mean that our working group will focus solely on what is necessary to protect the rights of... hold on, I have to mute my speaker because I've actually just made it into the chat room. Thank goodness. We're going to focus the rest of our work on what is necessary to protect the rights in the domain name system of international governmental organizations that are created by treaties or other means, and the members of which are governments. Is there a general agreement on that going forward? Is there any dissent on that point? Let me put it that way. I'll take silence as assent. Okay. All right, so I'm in the chat room now. All right, let me just bring up your email with the... What is the next agenda item? I'm going to bring up that email, but I want to stick to the program here.
Yeah, Phil, the agenda, if you can see it, I don't know how your Adobe screen is set up. It's on the right side in the notes pod, and while you bring up the email, Petter has his hand up.
Sorry, it was meant to... I just agreed to that summarize conclusion.
Okay. All right, Mary, I'm getting over to... all right. Okay, so I think we've finished with item two. Developing potential considerations for IGOs and INGOs for we're going to strike and INGOs that be relevant to their use of DRPs. I think that's a good place to discuss the document which George unearthed and shared with us last week. That was a document. And George, if you could just check, what year was that? It was a State Department memo on how the U.S. Was going to treat the protection of entities that were covered by Article 16 of the Paris Convention. What was the date of that memo? I think it was about 10 or 12 years ago.
George here, I just posted a link to it on the chat room. It's June 7th, 2002.
That's what I thought, 2002.
Long-standing advice.
And so that was fairly, I forget when the last iteration of the Paris Convention was done. But with the two key takeaways I took from that was that the memo noted that each nation was free to, implement the protections of the Paris Convention in its own manner. And, of course, in the U.S., treaties are not self-executing. There has to be additional steps taken by the legislature or executive to implement them. So at least the U.S. approach was going to be that an entity, an IGO under sixth tier, if it wanted to protect its rights in the United States, had to register not a trademark but a record of its protection, its coverage under the Paris Convention, with the Patent and Trademark Office, that would then be used to block conflicting trademarks. And if somehow someone was operating in the U.S. in violation of that registration, their remedy was to bring a civil lawsuit in the courts of the U.S. So I think the key things from that were that in the United States, at least, if you're an IGO, you need to, and you want protection, you need to register at the PTO, not a trademark, but a record of your coverage, and that your remedy generally was to bring civil litigation, just like any other entity. So the United States, at least, did not see a sovereign immunity issue with requiring that of IGOs to protect their rights in the United States. Which raised the question with May and in the pre-call with the chairs, Petter and I discussed with Mary, that we need to know more about how other sovereign nations have approached their obligations under the Paris Convention. And if we, of course, it's very instructive, we find that, that many of them have taken a similar approach, including utilizing their civil court system as a protection. That would be highly informative to our work and might lead to the conclusion that there was not a valid sovereign immunity issue to use of the current UDRP-URS with their appeals process to courts of national jurisdiction. And then the other, we might not need to have an organization have a trademark, registered or otherwise, but simply haven't taken the steps somewhere to register their rights under the Paris Convention. And if they had done so, that could we could propose a fairly simple amendment to the UDRP to provide standing in that instance. So I'm going to be quiet now and open up the discussion to the implications of that June 7, 2002 State Department program and what others think the what others think it means and how it might inform the further work of this working group. And I see no hands raised. Does this important document not raise any urge to discuss it in any way among other members of this working group in terms of how we should proceed? You know, I think basically I'm suggesting that we should try to find out how other nations have implemented their obligations under the Paris Convention.
Bill,
we all agree.
George and I have our hands raised, so maybe George could go first.
Speaking. Yeah, I just want to say I do agree with you, Phil. So the silence wasn't saying dissent, obviously, from my
posting. Oh, sorry. Yeah, now I see your hand. Sorry about that.
My posting of the letter to the mailing list was, you know, obviously with a position that IGOs shouldn't get special treatment with regards to the mutual jurisdiction slash immunity issue. If in the real world, in the offline world, when they're doing enforcement, they need to go to the courts. So they don't have any special dispensation that, you know, that it goes to some, you know, international tribunal or some other venue. That if the actual enforcement in the offline world involves going to the national courts, then the same legal standards should exist with regards to the online world and domain names. That was just my point.
Yeah, I'd agree with that as a general proposition, and I'll note for the record that in the world of we're talking, of course, about a ICANN-created curative rights process, whether it's the current ones, UDRP, URS, or a new one, which offers a faster and substantially less expensive alternative to protection of rights when a party believes that they've been infringed by a domain name. And the actual incidents where the sovereign immunity issue might even arise would only be if a registrant prevailed in a UDRP or URS, which is a minority situation. Most complainants prevail when they file a UDRP or URS. And it's even more rare, and it's not unheard of, for a registrant to either appeal a UDRP or URS or to truncate them by filing an intervening case in a court of national jurisdiction to move the dispute straight into the courts. It does happen sometimes, but it's a very small percentage of the total number of filings that occurs. And Mary, I recognize you. Your hand is raised.
Thanks, Phil, and thanks, George, for the comments. I wonder if this specific question on the sovereign immunity might be a good question for us to bring to the small group of the IGO coalition that, as I've noted previously, is being formed. And, you know, this was something that the GNSO and the board discussed at the joint meeting in Los Angeles. The reason I suggest that as staff support for this group, George, I note your answer, your question in the chat. I do not know that. I will find out from staff support to the board and hopefully have that answer for you in due course, in quick time. But it seems that because this issue is something that has been raised previously, including in GAC advice, it would be worthwhile for us to engage in an exchange with the IGOs. Another thing that I thought of as Phil and George were speaking, again, as staff support, is that this may circle back in some ways to Paul's and others' points earlier on about the basis for creating a separate dispute resolution procedure. I think the question was asked in our working group, if it's not trademarks, then what is it? And the second question that was asked was, well, is it enough that there is protection specifically when an IGO name and acronym is used as a trademark because of 6.2 of the Paris Convention? And it may well be that circling back to that question, what should be the standing or the basis, could involve a discussion of a second point, which is B, I suppose, in that the UDRP and the URS, in their various phrasings, does require an affirmative submission to a court of a national jurisdiction in filing the complaint. And Jim and Petter and others on this call know better than I do what that entails and the papers and so forth. But not that I'm saying this is a good reason, but it may be something that has some implication for IGOs because of their status. And so for those two reasons, Phil, I would propose that we try to address the specific question to the IGOs before we make a determination. Thanks. And so I also had some other suggestions that we discussed.
Mary, just for clarification, what is this? Could you restate the specific question you want to pose to the IGOs? And there may be other questions we want to pose to them as well, but what was the one you had in mind?
Well, just thinking off the top of my head, I think it's more of a general question. Maybe I shouldn't have used the word specific, as in the working group would like to, you know, understand in greater depth and detail the specific concerns that IGOs have with using the UDRP and the URS. You know, we understand that there is a concern about sovereign immunity, but that does not seem to be a problem in enforcing trademark rights, for example. So something along those lines, Phil, like setting out that we understand that there is a concern, but we'd like to understand in greater detail and more specifically why it's a problem for curative rights for domain names.
Right, right. Yeah, and I think we'd want to add to that. I'd like to know how they have, in nations like the U.S., which in order to protect their rights outside the domain name system, they have to make some type of registration at the PTO, how they have done that. Because the only reason that the, as a basis for bringing a civil lawsuit, if say, you know, let's take UNESCO as an example. UNESCO issues holiday cards, raises money that way. If somebody was putting out counterfeit UNESCO holiday greeting cards and they wanted to bring an action to stop that, they'd have to avail themselves of the U.S. court system to get an injunction against that. So they may not have agreed in advance affirmatively to submit to a court somewhere, but the only point of making the U.S. registration would be to have standing if they needed access to the court system. So I think we want to know how they've moved to implement their Paris Convention rights in various nations and whether that implicitly might involve them in civil litigation in those nations.
Phil, it's Jim Bykoff. Can I get in the queue?
Sure. Yeah, Jim, why don't you go ahead and then George says his hand up. We'll get back to George.
Yeah, I was just going to say, going back to Mary's comment, it might be prudent to pose those questions first to the GACs, since they're the ones that have made the representations about the IGOs needing this special type of remedy in order to access the UDRP and the URS, because I don't know if there's one person who can speak for all the IGOs at this point, but since the GAC has raised this, maybe bring this as one of the questions to the GAC and let them run interference with the IGOs.
Well, actually, Jim, in the pre-call, Petter and I discussed that with Mary. She was concerned that if we asked the GAC, we could be waiting a very long time for any type of response, that it might not be comprehensive, that it might be more pragmatic to go directly to this IGO representative group once it's established, while keeping the GAC informed of what we're doing. You know, we can explore that. George, what did you have to say here?
Yeah, George Greco speaking. I just want to point out in subgroup B, we had actually talked about that a bit, that we should, what questions we wanted to raise to the IGOs, and one of the questions was, you know, how they do their enforcement of existing rights in the offline world compared to, you know, domain names, as that would give us a guide.
Mia, vai, qui.
Hello?
Vai.
Somebody's talking.
Someone needs to silence their line. Thank you.
Excuse me, this is Larry. I'm looking for that line at this time.
Yeah, we've got some very young stakeholders. I don't think they're adhering to the ICANN standards of conduct in those remarks, but we'll move.
The raise was we don't have Kathy on the line today, at least so far, but back when the UDRP was being created, you know, cyber squatting was considered to be a wild west where, you know, people could go to the courts, would have to go to the courts to enforce their rights. And the UDRP bargain, so to speak, was that people still had the right to go to court, but that this alternate procedure would exist if both sides wanted to do it. The ability to actually go to the courts was definitely a big factor in having people have acceptance of the UDRP as a policy. If it was a mandatory policy where, you know, there was no appeal to the national courts, probably the UDRP would not have been struck in the first place. And I think Kathy could probably speak to that a lot more if she were on the call.
Yeah, and that, you know, my view on that is, you know, that would, in effect, you'd have ICANN depriving citizens of various jurisdictions of their legal rights in those jurisdictions. I don't believe ICANN has any ability to do that. So you're correct in that both UDFP or U.S. are basically a consensual system in which both sides have agreed to use that arbitration process in lieu of a standard court process, and either one is free. The complainant would always be free to file a trademark infringement action in court, and the registrant is free to either appeal the UDFP decision or basically to stop the UDRP process through a filing in a national court. So, yeah, that is a good observation, George. So do others have views on this issue, which I guess is two issues here. Standing, is there something other than trademark rights? And it might be, as in the U.S., simply registration of your Paris Convention coverage with the PTO. That could be an element for being a complainant in a existing DRP, as well as the sovereign immunity issue, which if various nations have already told entities covered by the Paris Convention that their remedy for offline claims of infringement in those nations is through civil litigation, it would certainly, I don't know, I don't want to say it negates the sovereign immunity issue, but it certainly is a major raises major questions about the validity of that argument.
Bill, this is Mary again.
Yes.
Would this be a good point to bring up the suggestion that the chairs and staff discussed on our pre-call about using ICANN's general counsel to assist at least in part?
Yeah, that was discussed in the pre-call, and the general counsel's office has done research in the past on issues related to the subject matter of this working group. So the co-chairs have no objection and welcome the suggestion that the request be made to ICANN legal staff to see what else they could dig up on this subject. It may well be that someone, in the intervening years between the enactment of the relevant sections of the Paris Convention and now there may well be a law review article or some other research somewhere discussing how various nations have actually implemented their obligations under the Paris Convention, and if we could find that, would be highly informative to our work. So, does anyone have comments on or objections to the notion of requesting further assistance on this point from the General Counsel's office at ICANN?
Nope.
Okay. I note that in that June 7, 2002 telegram from the State Department to the UN, U.S. Rep office at the UN, point one says USUN is requested to send a note in paragraph two to the UN Legal Counsel in response to his inquiry regarding the domain name registration for an internet site. I don't know if that UN Counsel has taken similar action against in regard to other domains, but perhaps and is willing to share information. But it does suggest that some communication with the Legal Counsel of the United Nations on the implementation of the Paris Convention might be a fruitful avenue. I don't know what others think of that suggestion. Because if they've asked the U.S. to respond on this, they may have asked other nations and gotten replies back from them. I don't know if they'll share that information, but it may be they may be holding valuable information. All right, well, I'll take the lack of comments as full agreement with everything I've said on that point. So let me let 48 minutes past the hour. We've been dealing with question three on developing potential considerations for IGOs and INGOs. Just IGOs, we're striking and INGOs that are relevant to the use of DRPs. We've discussed the standing issue vis-a-vis the Paris Convention, and we've also touched on the sovereign immunity issue in the context of how they enforce their offline rights under the Paris Convention. Do others have anything more to say on that subject? On item three, or if not, I think we'll move the discussion on with about 10 minutes to go to next steps for this working group. All right. Well, I think already on the table is the notion of giving an oral report to the council at their December meeting. We discussed the possibility of having the council establish an official non-staff liaison with this working group, and I suggested Mason might be the right person, already participating and already being the one who's going to interface with the GAC on some of the issues we're dealing with. But looking toward a call next week and moving on with a focus solely on IGOs going forward, how do people think we should proceed for our meeting next week to, which I believe at this point we're really looking at, are there valid reasons for IGOs to not use the UDRP or URF, be it standing, sovereign immunity, or other issues? And if there are, can they be dealt with through some amendments? I don't want to say minor, I don't prejudge the scope of them, but some changes to the existing term rights process going down the very difficult and arduous road of creating an entirely new CRP for IGOs. So I think we're going to be digging deeper into standing and other issues for access to a dispute resolution process and I don't have any specific suggestions at this moment of how of what we should focus on next week. Others on the call have ideas.
Focus is Mary.
Yes, Mary.
Actually, I'll speak to Jim and go after.
That's fine. I was just going to say, Phil, that the idea of contacting this IGO coalition, do we know that they represent all the IGOs or only some of them? Could we find out more information? Who is on this coalition, what groups they represent, and whether they would be speaking for all IGOs or whether we would need to, contact separately IGOs to make sure that we're inclusive in getting the views for all the IGOs?
Sure. Well, I don't know if we'll ever get the views of every single IGO, but we certainly need to know who's... Mary had indicated in the chat that she wasn't sure that group would even be established yet. If it's not established yet, it's just information. We can't check yet on who's in it. But I think once it's established, we can see who's in there. We can also say they have a process where they're keeping the other IGOs informed and thereby where we might view them as reflecting the views of more than just the specific members of the group, but I think it's premature to know the answer to that question.
Well, the other thing I was going to suggest was some of us may have contacts with IGOs. I know I do. And maybe we can discuss next week whether any of us would be willing to approach the IGOs we know and with some kind of a questionnaire that we could organize on these points to try to find out what the issues are.
I think that's a good idea. That's a good idea. Petter, I see your hand up.
Yeah, Petter Ringford here. Just a short note. I think that once the group is established, they are representing the IGOs, and especially they are representing the IGOs that are actually active in this question. So, of course, we can informally reach out to get inputs from representatives we know about. But two issues. At the end, we need to have more formal reply from official representatives of IGOs, and once there is an official group, as I said, that will also be the group that are specifically interested and active in this question. So I don't deny anyone to talk to people we know. I think several of us have contacts with other representatives, but the most important would be to actually get active input from the former group. Thanks.
Phil, can I respond to Petter?
Sure, go ahead, Jim.
I think Petter hit it right. Once this group is established, and if they do, as Petter suggests, represent all the IGOs, perhaps they would be willing to have a representative or one or more representatives join this group.
Well, that would be ideal from my view, from my perspective, so they could take part directly and help us shape our work rather than reacting to our work.
Exactly.
Bill, this is Mary. Can I get back in the queue on this and other points?
Sure.
So to partially respond to George's, Petter's, and Jim's points, I think Petter's already covered quite a lot of it. My understanding is that the IGO group would function, at least in terms of representative views, much like the IGO representatives and the coalition on the previous group that Jim and others were involved with. They also submitted comments in relation to the public comment forum for not just the previous group, but the preliminary issue report for our current working group. So that's my understanding, that regardless of which IGO is or is not in that group, that would be their function and that would be their role. Certainly, it would be helpful for working group members with contacts at IGOs to funnel the same questions to them, because the more input, the better. And lastly, on this point, like I noted in the chat and as Phil noted, we do have an action item about the IGO invitations that we can send through the GAC secretariat. But on that note, too, a reminder that we do have not just GAC members on our working group like Gary, but as an observer, we also have WIPO. So they would be kept abreast of our discussions by the mailing list as well as by recordings and transcripts of our calls. And so hopefully, you know, there may be better and further participation going forward, but it's not to say that there is none right now.
Right. Yeah, and WIPO, of course, is a very important member of this group. Not only is it an IGO as a UN agency, but it is the leading arbitration provider for the UDRP, at least. Historically, it's had the most number of UDRP filings per year, so it has tremendous experience with the actual administration of dispute resolution procedures relating to domain names. So its perspective is very welcome by our working group. Let me do that. It's 3 minutes before the hour. If anyone on this call other than Mary, I see her hand still up. I don't know if that's something further to say, Mary. has something to say about what we should be doing next week, please share it. If you're not ready to share it now, let's all think about what we want to get on to next week. I think we've made progress. We've narrowed things down to where we're just dealing with ideas going forward. We've unearthed some very important information about how the United States implements Paris Convention rights in the offline world, which suggests that we need to build our database for how other nations handle it. And we're going to be proceeding at looking at the potential obstacles to use of the current DRPs and deciding whether those are valid concerns, and if they are valid concerns, how they can best be addressed. If folks have ideas on what they want to discuss next week to move our work forward, our mailing list is always active. Share those thoughts on the mail list, and the co-chairs will take all that into consideration and work with staff to put together a positive agenda for next week that will move our work forward. And Mary, I see your hand up. So let's give you the last word, and then let's close down the call.
Oh, that's very kind. It was an old hand for two new points, actually. The first, in response to next week, one thing that the co-chairs and the working group might want to consider is whether for next week or the week after, we might need to take a break for a week or so to do a couple of things. One, to review what we've already done, and as I noted previously, staff will send out a summary for that. And secondly, to await, you know, Mason, for example, engaging with the GAC and to finalize our questions for the IGOs, which can be done by email. So, Phil and Petter, that's one suggestion that the both of you may want to consider.
You know, my suggestion is that we have a call next week and then take a break the week of the 24th, if for no other reason that Wednesday, November 26th, is the day before Thanksgiving in the U.S. And I know that an awful lot of people in the U.S. are not going to be on that call because people tend to be either traveling to their Thanksgiving destinations or getting ready for visitors, and I anticipate that we're going to have very low U.S. participation. And also a lot of our ICANN support staff is all based in the U.S. They may have travel plans as well. So I would suggest that we, you know, try to make some more progress next week and then take a break the week of the 24th and then reconvene on Wednesday, December 3rd. What do others think of that suggestion?
Phil, this is
Jim Bykoff. I think it's a good suggestion.
Yeah. Thanks, Jim.
Okay. We will keep that on the schedule as suggested. And the last point I wanted to make, so I'm aware as 1 minute passed, is to remind folks to let us know if you plan to be on the ground in Singapore for planning purposes for our face-to-face meeting. And the reason for that is because we do need a critical mass, if you like, of folks not just on the phone but also in the room. So I did send an email around if folks could let us know as soon as they know if they're planning to travel to Singapore in February. That would be much appreciated. And that's it, Phil.
Yeah, and if you're not sure on that point, but think you're leaning toward attending, that would be useful too. If you're sure you're attending or sure you're not attending, that would be highly useful information. I hope we have enough attendance in Singapore to hold that face-to-face meeting, that we don't have to put it off till the mid-year meeting, which is going to be somewhere in Latin America. I'm hearing Mexico, but it's not firm yet. I think it would be very useful for our group to have that facilitated face-to-face meeting. But I do realize that attendance in Singapore may be negatively affected both by the fact that we're returning to the venue where we met just 1 year ago at the time of the meeting, and that it is an expensive venue in terms of both travel costs and hotel costs, at least at the venue hotels. So, but give us really an indication as you can of whether you're thinking of attending the Singapore meeting. And with that, I think we'll end this call and look forward to talking again next week, taking off the following week, and please send in your ideas for what we should focus on next week to make that a useful discussion. Thank you very much.
Thanks.
That concludes today's conference. You may disconnect at this time.